Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 72 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming, news and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, role-playing games, not football.
But not football, because the Colts have stopped playing football, so...
So why should we talk about it?
That's right. So we'll just be waiting for baseball season to pick back up next year, starting fresh. And speaking of starting fresh, we're not going to do what we originally planned with the top 11. We've pushed it back one episode.
Keeping you in suspense.
Keeping you in suspense for that one extra episode, because we have a very special guest. The gaming in public / gaming in libraries topic that's gone on for a few episodes now has really just picked up a head of steam, and we have picked up the guy to talk about this. That's Mr. Scott Nicholson.
Dr. Scott Nicholson.
Dr. Scott Nicholson. Sorry, excuse me.
That's right.
We will have him in the big deal where he will talk all about gaming in libraries, because a lot of you have had questions, and John, the playing the part of the unwashed masses.
I am.
I go to the library and get a book, you know, so...
Hey.
Yeah, sorry.
So we'll be bringing you a great interview and discussion with Scott. We're also going to be reviewing the new Kickstarter hotness that just hit the streets. It hasn't even hit the streets yet, I don't think. I think it's still on the boat or something, and that's Eminent Domain from Tasty Minstrel Games. And we'll give you our full thoughts on that, guys. So when it finally does hit the streets, you know, you'll be ready to either jump on it or jump away from it.
Or lead to an action that does not involve you jumping onto it.
Exactly.
We have some special sponsors for this episode.
That's right. As always, our episode is sponsored by Myriad Games, our stalwart sponsor of...
Your friend in the gaming business.
Many years, yeah. And we'll be talking about them later. But like we mentioned last episode, for the month of September, we also have taken on a new sponsor, and that's Clever Mojo Games. They're the makers of Alien Frontiers, and they've got a couple of great Kickstarter projects for an expansion to Alien Frontiers, the Factions expansion, as well as the new board game Sunrise City. And so we'll be talking a little bit about more about all those exciting things coming up from Clever Mojo. We do thank them for their support. As always, our episode is going to start off with a rundown, and that starts
now. All right, it is time for the rundown. But before we get into the rundown, we want to talk about our great sponsor, Myriad Games.
That was the penance. The call to the
That's like Monty Python and the Grail there.
Yeah, well, but anyway. I'm looking at a Monty Python to Holy Grail poster that's right
you
behind
are.
You.
Yes, indeed.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Thank you. We're giving our due penance, our due homage to Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional gaming stores everywhere. And Myriad Games, a lot of the games we're talking about, some of them are the new hotness. And we don't always chase the cult of the new.
Not always. Sometimes.
But when we do, we prefer Myriad Games.
That's right.
So stay thirsty, my friends, and check out MyriadGames.com. Get an MVP membership today. Stretch your gaming dollar to its maximum possible value today. John,
not tomorrow, today.
Today.
Do it now.
Do it right now. Okay. We have agents everywhere.
Turn off the podcast,
you.
Go to Myriad Games, go back to the podcast.
After the podcast, okay. You can listen to it. So, John, what have you been playing?
All right, kind of a sparse rundown again. Mm-hmm. It was sparse last time, and I don't know what's...
Quality over quantity.
Okay.
Put it that way.
Been a lot of stuff going on at work, been real busy mm-hmm. lately. So, let's see, I've been playing HeroScape. I know I mentioned this a lot now. That's become sort of a go-to game for me and my son now, and over the course of successive weeks of playing this... Ethan's got it down now. I mean, yeah. What usually happens, the progression is, he builds his army. It's usually like 800 points. I have to cull it. He builds it based upon which guys look cool.
You got to pick the Hulk. I mean, he's like 600 points.
He didn't want to play with any of the Marvel. We played on the Marvel board, but he didn't want to play with any of the superheroes.
Oh, the Hulk's awesome.
Yeah, so he picked out like the Aubrey and Archers and... Like the angel guy with the sword, and so you know the guys look pretty cool and everything. But and the werewolves, the Nubian wolves, very cool. But he picked all those guys out, and I picked some guys out, and he almost beat me.
Straight up?
Fair and square, straight up. And he made one mistake that, I, you know, if I had corrected him on it, he would have.
You snuck in and crushed him for it.
No, it ended up with, I only had one guy left, one member of the 4th Massachusetts line, standing there by himself on the battlefield going, where'd everybody go?
Nice.
That's just becoming more and more fun. That's just, we haven't mentioned it yet. There's a gamer who put together a geek list on Board Game Geek for podcasters talking about.
He asked us to pick our top 5 games out of the BGG top 10 ranked games.
Right.
And then to pick one game that's not in the top 10 that we think should be in the top 10.
Right. And the game that I picked, and you can go to that geek list. We'll put a link to that geek list in the show notes. It's real interesting. They got lots of different podcasters that kind of weighed in on this. But the game I suggested to put in the top 10 is HeroScape. I know it's not a Board Game Geek style game, but I've had so much fun with it. It's still great. It's one of those purchases that in 10 years, that's the one game that I'm going to totally not regret having spent so much money on. Because I think that I'll still be playing it.
Yeah, you can get a lot of mileage out of it.
Exactly. So played a lot of that. Let's see. Played Stone Age.
Yes.
The great worker placement gem with Cody and Kalen.
Yeah, that was kind of my idea to bring that bad boy out and I guess try it because I'm always looking for good two-player games, and I was going to try it two-player with Kalen, but we decided to play a three-player game. We hadn't played in a while, and it's a delightful game.
Oh, it's good.
I like it. Yeah, it's, you know, there are other worker placement games. That one may be one of my favorites, just because in that kind of Euro style, I like that because it's just there's not a lot of fluff with it. It's straightforward, and I enjoy it.
In a way, the thing I like about it the most is that it almost has kind of a gambling element to it. It's not like you're saying, I'm putting two guys down here, and that means I'll get 2 stone. Mm-hmm. It's you're putting guys down there, and it's going to give you a chance to get 2 stone, right, or however many stone. And the roll of those dice make it a little bit more interesting, I think. And it's especially fun when you are on the gold thing, and you put 5 guys there. You have to roll a 6, don't you, to get a gold? And you know, all of your guys tank. You know, that's a lot of fun to, you know, for that little element of chance. So we played that. We've played some. Most of the things I've played with you, actually. We played Glory to Rome.
Yeah, we brought that one out. That's one. There's a Kickstarter for this. Rome Demands Beauty is what it calls, because Glory to Rome has been lauded as a great strategic game. It is the seriously strategic strategy card game as per the current box.
Yeah.
But it is ugly as sin. It has just terrible artwork, and it's just
it's cartoony artwork. It's not terrible.
It's noisy. It's bad.
It's not terrible if you're reading a comic strip, but it just doesn't fit the game.
For the
at
purpose
all.
Of the game, it is terrible.
Okay.
Someone has designed this very kind of minimalist, very chic version of Glory to Rome, which is going to be produced, and they just had a Kickstarter thing for it, and it funded. John and I originally both were on board. This is before we played it. I backed out because I'm like, well, I've not played it.
You don't want to support something you haven't played.
You have to make purchases matter, remember.
We've talked about that.
So one of us stayed true to that.
Yes, and I did not.
And I backed off. But I was curious, since John did, so we decided to break it out and play it. I think it's a hit.
It's fun. It's really fun.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
And we'll be talking about Eminent Domain a little bit later, and that's definitely got some ties
to that game.
You
can see the Glory to Rome there. It's also a great two-player game, because we learned it as a three-player game. I played it heads up with Kalen, and it's a really good two-player game.
Really?
It's very nice. Very nice.
Very nice.
So I won't get the Kickstarter goodies, but I think I am going to buy the new version when it comes out.
Excellent. And I'm looking forward to it. I did not back out of that.
You're brave.
I'm glad that I didn't. And played some Couriers. After we played Glory to Rome, played some Couriers. That's still a lot of fun. You know, the buzz around the internet about Couriers is, you know, kind of meh. It's not... At the same, it's kind of meh among the board game geek people, but among sales figures, like you look at different online gaming sites, that'll say what the top games are that they're selling. Couriers is up there, man. So I don't know how it's really being received.
I'm getting the inkling that it may very well be a flash in the pan.
Really,
I think 6 months from now it may be dead. I mean, not dead, but you know, no one's really talking about it because I mean, I can't really think of. I can't think of a game off the top of my head, but you know those games that are just hot, 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 and then 6 months later...
Not, not, not.
Yeah, I mean, you just don't really hear anything about it, and you're just, oh, well, guess it...
Well, I usually hear that with collectible card games. Every time at Gen Con, you know, it's the 24, the collectible
card games. Which CCG will be introduced to Gen Con and then fold the next year. But there's a couple games there, too, that are, you know, kind of a big thing, and then they kind of fade off and you don't hear anything about them.
You were mentioning that about Battleship Galaxies.
Yeah, I mentioned that too. That's actually a good thing. Battleship Galaxies, that came out and it was just everyone was talking about it. Everyone had to have it. And I mentioned to John today, I think we were talking about HeroScape, and that got me thinking about Battleship Galaxies. It's like, you know, I don't hear a peep about that game anymore.
And sadly, Cody and I have played it. I'm not sure if we talked it up very much on the show here, but you know, we liked it.
Yeah, it was fine.
It was fine, but yeah, it's still sitting on my shelf there, and I haven't felt that compelled to pull it back out. So I don't know what's the deal with that. So we got to get at the table to see whether that has some longevity or not. Played a new card game from Moustache Games called Hike. And they were nice enough to provide us with a review copy of this guy, so thanks for that. This is a game that has a lot of links, I think, to Uno. You know, you sort of think about, you have to get a certain number of cards, you have to get rid of all of them, and you play a certain card, and you know, and then it has a suit that's associated with
leading
it.
And following and all that.
Yeah, like that. But you know, in Uno, you've got the colors and the numbers, right? And so you can play a card on top that's the same color or the same number. And in this game, The theme is you're going on a hike. And so you have things like the trail and the lake and a bird
and
a tree.
And the best card in the game.
The poop card?
The poop card.
There's the poop card. Yeah,
in a game with a poop card.
Yeah. Well, and that card, there's bug cards. Oh. And so if someone plays the poop card, then it draws all the bugs.
Oh,
so you get all the bugs out of your hand. So
I get it.
Yeah. Very themey. And unlike something like Uno, where it's, you know, red three, you got to play a red or a three. A card like the lake, you know, will have three different symbols on it, three different symbols and colors. So, and I don't have the cards in front of me, but you know, the lake, you might get to play a tree and a bird and a trail as the possibilities of what you can play on top of that. And so you're trying to get these cards out of your hand in a game of Uno. And really the company that makes this game, you might be hating right now that I'm comparing it to Uno, but it's the game that I thought of.
Yeah. Uno, not a bad game.
No, Uno's a good game. That when you can't play a card in Uno, you just draw a card, right? And then you just get more cards in your hand. It takes longer to get rid of them. In Hike, if you can't play a card, you're out of the round.
Oh.
And so you put all of your cards down that you still have in your hand. But you know, you don't put them back in the deck. You just leave them there in front of you. And then the game continues until you get to the last person either getting rid of all their cards or they get to the point where they can't play anything else and then they're out. And then you count and see who has the fewest number of cards left, and then that person wins the round. And then the way the scoring works is that person is going to win points equal to the number of total cards in the whole game of all players that are left over. Mm-hmm. And then you play, depending on the number of players, you play to a certain number of points. Also, you get a bonus, like a 3-point bonus, if you get rid of all of your cards. And so that's different. I mean, I didn't terribly dislike that. I guess it was okay. I think this is definitely a game that's really good for families and for younger kids, more than for like a gaming group. Like if you had your D&D group and you're looking for a card filler,
kind of like Elementis in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that really reminded me of that one as well. Yeah, that it's not the game to play, you know, while you're waiting for your D&D group to show up.
Sure.
But you know, I played with my two kids who are, you know, 8 and 5, and then they both loved it. And you know, the nice thing is that even though it does have some text on the cards, my 5-year-old who can't quite read yet, she was still able to, you know, match up the symbols and be able to play the right cards there. So that was, just had to help her with the special cards a little bit. But I thought it was pretty fun. And like I said, with the smaller kids and with a family sort of setting, I think it'd be a pretty, pretty good game. So that's Hike. What else? We played Talisman.
We did.
You can talk about that in a second.
Oh, okay.
If you want to. Do you want to go talk about it
now?
You
seem to really enjoy it. So let's let's talk about it.
Okay. Okay, Cody's going to beat me up over this. So, Talisman.
The magical quest game.
The magical quest game. Cody has had this on his top 11 for, you know, the last few years.
Since the beginning of time.
Since the beginning of time. It's one of your favorite games and a nostalgic game for you, right?
Yes, very, very much so. I don't like it because of its thrilling mechanics.
Right.
I don't need 800 emails in the inbox. Well, it's really just a roll of I get it.
Yeah, Cody gets it.
I understand.
And, you know, this is not my favorite game. I like the theme of the game quite a bit. And the way they implement it, I think, is, you know, pretty cool. But it just goes too long. And for me, a game that there has to be a balance between luck and length of play. Something that's really lucky, I just don't want to spend 3 to 4 hours playing. And we played a five-player game?
Six-player.
So it was a six.
Too many.
Oh, yeah. Six-player game.
And we 3 to 4 is a sweet spot for
Talisman. How many expansions did we play with?
Four of them.
With four of the expansions. And the game took, I think,
four hours.
4 hours,
which is not terrible for a game of Talisman.
Yeah. And John the Leprechaun won.
John the Leprechaun, yeah. Big winner.
So I was a big winner there. So for what it is and for the theme that it brings and evokes, I do like it. It's just too long. So
I agree. I mean, it's just nostalgic for me. My first, like I've mentioned before, my first kind of gamery board game. I'm kind of getting to the point though where, you know, I was kind of fading in and out a little bit, but Talisman is all about, and we experience this in the game, it's all about just kind of BSing with your friends and that kind of experience of you don't have to be completely focused on the game and the luck swings. You have to take it like a champ. You can't get really upset if your character dies or gets turned into a toad, because it's just going to happen. And I like it because you can be winning and the next minute you can be just down. Or you could be at the bottom of the heap and then you get a stroke of luck and you're right back in it. And it's good every so often. And I completely agree with you about the luck and play time being kind of inversely proportional. Because it's like, God forbid, I don't want to play a half an hour game of Flux, let alone a 4 hour game of Flux. But with Talisman, every so often, it's just that experience game that I think is worth bringing out. And I have to say, that list we mentioned earlier, Talisman was the game I would promote. Top 10 to the top 10, which okay. I will ruffle feathers.
No, that's fine.
What was I going to mention? Oh, I've kind of always wanted to get a copy of the second edition of the game from the 80s because that's the edition I played and kind of fell in love with. I only got the new edition because it was the only one that didn't cost hundreds of dollars for the base game.
Sure.
But going on eBay the other day, you have these like copies of the second edition game and the expansions, you know, in really good shape and 100% complete, going for very realistic prices, you know, like $40 for the base game, you know, $20 for the expansion. So
I wonder if that's because, I'm sure probably because of the reprint, right?
There's no demand. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no demand for it anymore.
I remember when Betrayal at House on the Hill, before it got reprinted, and mm-hmm. that terrible reprint that they did of it. But before that, copies of the original version of that were going for $100.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember seeing it in a store one time at $40. I should have bought it. But I'm sure as soon as that new version came out,
the bottom dropped out. There's a game that fell off the radar, by the way. The reprint of Betrayal.
No, yeah, you don't hear about that.
You know, like last year we were getting radioed Extra Life and everyone was talking it up, and now
nothing
at all.
Yeah. Last thing in my rundown is I played a game of chess with my wife.
Really? You're not a chess guy. You're not an abstract strategy guy.
I'm not an abstract strategy guy. I'm not really a chess guy. But I did play, you know, when I was a kid, and you know, I know how to play, of course. But my church has been using some games in church, and not really so much in church service, but for the kids before church service starts, before they actually get the service started, well, they'll pull out some games. They play Blockus and you know, some other games like that. And so I guess they've gotten lots of donations in of toys and games for the, you know, nursery and kids area. And so I guess since the leaders there know that I'm the game guy, mm-hmm. if they get a game that they either A, don't want to be, you know, want in the church, or that they don't understand or don't know how to play, they give it to Ethan, who then brings it to me. Nice. And so we got a copy of, like, you know, the Lego Bionicle sets?
Yeah, yeah.
There's like some Lego Bionicle board game.
Huh.
And so I have a copy of that. I guess we'll
cool.
Cody, not Cody.
No.
Ethan and I will get that to the table at some point.
There you go.
But Ethan brought this week a copy of this game called Chess 4.
Wow, I didn't realize there were sequels.
It's 4-player chess.
Mm.
Yeah, but one side of the board is 4-player chess with 4. You know, I guess it's the same rules of chess. It's just.
It's kind of wacky.
But the other side of the board is just normal chessboard. And so I taught Ethan and my wife, who hadn't really ever played before, I taught kind of how all the pieces move and everything. And they played a game. And then Rachel wanted to play a game with me. And we played. And she really liked it.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, and I'll play chess. That's fine. But I was telling her about Confusion, Espionage, mm-hmm. Deception of the Cold War, the new one from Stronghold Games. Which is very chess-like, and she seemed like that was very interesting to her, so she wanted to play that one. So I don't get a chance to play with games with my wife too often because we have some kind of different interests. She'll definitely sit down and play with me on occasion, but you know, she has a business that she runs from home and so forth. So So, you know, the fact that she was so excited about playing this, that was kind there of a green light for me. So, all right, I've talked for long enough.
Now, when you get that copy of Twilight Imperium through the church, you know, that someone donates, yeah, you can bring that over and we'll play that.
Absolutely.
There's a great game.
Yeah. All right, what about you? What have you been playing?
Well, John mentioned some of the things we'd played together. Glory to Rome, Talisman, the beautiful gem that it is. some other things I played, I had a chance to get Lords of Vegas to the table.
Ooh.
I finally bought it. It had been kind of this glaring hole in my collection just because I really love that game, and I finally picked it up. Got a three-player game of that to the table, and it doesn't disappoint.
It's
I
fun.
Mean, you get that. You know, it's the right mix of luck and kind of a Euro mechanic, and you always get at least one stand-up die roll every time. Every time I've seen the game played, either if I've in it or if I've been watching it, there's always a moment where everyone stands up and you have that big reorganization roll and you roll it. And it's just such a fun game. Oh. And we played with poker chips, of course, is the only way to play it.
Yes. Lords Shame on you, Mayfair Games, for your paper money.
Oh. Yeah.
Although I guess they kept the price low.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty reasonable price. If you haven't played Lords of Vegas, this is my personal appeal to you. Go out, try it. You'll love it. If you don't, then you're wrong. It's a great game. Check out Lords of Vegas. Also, my buddy Dare brought over an old Milton Bradley game from the 80s. I posted a picture of this on our Facebook and Twitter account called Thunder Road.
Whoa.
And it's basically this Mad Max Road Warrior thing where you have three vehicles. You have like kind of a light little dune buggy, you have a medium car, and you have this big kind of like tank thing. And the board is basically two interlocking sections of road and kind of off-road areas. And so you start at the back of, let's say, board two, if you're looking at it left or right, the rightmost board. And then you're going to be rolling dice and moving your car to the left, kind of down the road, right? And so once a car goes off of board one, the left board, then you take the second board and bring it around, and it becomes the first board.
Ah, okay.
Makes sense, right? So you're like you're traveling down the road. But the idea is you want to...
A thunder road,
if you were. So the idea is you want to ram other cars and shoot them, because if they're wrecked, after a time, if they're on the part of the road that gets cycled through, then they lose that. I mean, there's chances to repair it and all that, but you're basically just trying to outrun the other people and shoot up their cars at the same time. There's little helicopters you can bring in, and it's very 80s, it's very Ameritrash, it's very awesome.
Wow.
And we had a good time, and it's fun playing with those old things from, you know, back when, you know, we were kids. So it was really fun to play. So Thunder Road, it was an entertaining play. I've played a lot of Glory to Rome. I'm getting ready to run one of the Pathfinder adventure paths. I have a couple of the first adventures for a couple of their adventure paths, just to get you up to speed. Basically, the adventure paths are produced by Paizo, and they usually have some sort of theme. The one I'm running is called Carrion Crown, and it's very gothic horror. It's very Ravenloft, if you know old D&D. It's like that. And they're the series of six books that have adventures that take a party of adventures from level 1 to level, usually high level, like 14 at least, you know, and up there. So I'm getting ready to run that. I'm excited to do it. I like to, when I have time to prepare something for GM, I like to prepare little things. I've sent out, there are these little cards that you get. They're called hero cards that take place in the game. And they're kind of like tarot cards, but they're hero cards.
See what they did there.
Yeah, but they play a part in the game, and then they give characters special abilities. So I've sent those ahead to the players. And the idea, the thing that gets them all involved is that they're going to this funeral for this professor that they're all connected to in different ways. So I sent out basically the invitation to the funeral and for the reading of the will, and included was their hero card. I like doing stuff like that. I've got like music prep. I've got all these little effects ready. I'm ready to.
You have a body. And
I have a body. I've rented out a funeral home. It's great. The family mortuary really came through this time. So, no, it's great. I'm excited to be running that. I'll give you guys a full report. And in other geekery, I haven't really been reading much, but I have been reading a lot of the new DC Comics line of their reboot that they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of things have been really good. I've really enjoyed Batgirl's been good. Justice League International's been good. A couple things have not been so good. You know, Batwing, not great. Legion. Legion
what
Superhero.
Is Batwing?
He's a... So not to go comics on for too much, but
okay.
So basically there was this comic called Batman Incorporated. So basically Bruce Wayne, Batman, goes around and decides that, you know, Batman can't be everywhere at once. So he basically franchises out the Batman thing. It sounds so stupid. When I had someone tell me the premise of it before I read it, I'm like, well, that just sounds hokey, you know?
Wow.
But basically he goes to these different places and trains up people, you know? So there's a Batman in Japan. There's a Batman in Australia. And so Batwing is the Batman of Africa.
Okay.
Right. So he's in Africa. Yeah. So it's basically his story. The art was good. I didn't care for the story much.
Okay.
But there's a lot of good titles. I think I pulled about 25 out of the 52 to read their first issue. That'll probably get cut down to about 12 once we get past these first arcs. But
okay.
It's been fun getting into comics because with this DC reboot, it's been a nice ground floor for me to get in on. You know, I've always kind of wanted to. I've been jealous of comics readers. I never could really get into it. And now I can. It's been a lot of fun. So
you're a Superman guy. Right?
I'm a Superman
guy. When is Superman coming out?
It's at the end of September, so it'll probably be out not far after this. But he also appears in Justice League and in Action Comics. And the Superman they've presented so far is more of your like chaotic good Superman instead of your lawful good Superman.
Oh, crazy.
I'm all about truth, justice, and the American way Superman. Big American flag behind him, right? But I like it because they've taken his powers down. You know, it, no longer can he, you know, destroy everything with a look and fly around everywhere. He's back to like jumping and he doesn't.
He can't fly?
No, he leaps tall buildings in a single bound. It's back how it used to be. The flying was added, from what I understand, later on.
Really?
Yeah, because if you remember the old, you know, fashion the speeding bullet, da da da.
Yeah, yeah.
Leaps tall buildings in a single bound. Doesn't fly.
I didn't even think about that.
So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. I'm enjoying it. And like I said, it's this whole new world of geekery and it's. I might go to a comic book convention and, you know, I might get crazy and do that. So
awesome.
We'll see what happens.
Well, I've finally finished the Ghost Story, the last Dresden book.
You're caught up.
I'm caught up completely with the story. I'm now reading. I'm trying to just absorb all the Dresden I can, just get it all out of my system. And so I'm reading Side Jobs, which is the anthology of short stories, which is a great one to read if you've read all the other books, because a lot of them, it'll even tell you, you know, this story takes place between this book and this book. And it fills in a lot of gaps in the story of things that they didn't really even talk about in the books. And you find out some more information about some of the characters that you wouldn't have found out any other way. So that was a lot of fun. And, you know, this has sort of sparked in me a desire to check out the Dresden Files RPG.
I'm very excited.
I have, I picked the book up actually last year at Extra Life. Yeah. When I was at Myriad Games, I flipped through the book and it looked interesting. But at that time, I'd only read the first couple of books. And so I just didn't want to get the books spoiled too badly by looking through the RPG. But now I'm spoiler free, so I'll be in good shape there. But I really would like to check it out. I feel like I know the Dresden verse so well that I'd be able to GM it pretty easily if I know the rules to how the dice work and everything. So I'm thinking about trying that one out.
I'm excited. I might have to squeeze in if you're going to run that at Extra Life, maybe squeeze in the reading the first book before then in there.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, see if you can find an audiobook or something. I know that you had borrowed it before and it wasn't really cooking your bacon.
I also borrowed Game of Thrones once and didn't like it first time I read it.
Or so you need to buy it on your Kindle then. Yeah, and then you'll be able to.
That's probably the trick.
That'll be the catalyst to get
Amazon.com/Kindle.
Yeah. There you go. So anyway, I wanted to thank the listeners who have posted both in the guild and sent emails to the Game One inbox, giving me suggestions for books to read.
Oh, you've gotten a lot of them.
I've got a lot, and so I've got kind of a list going. This several folks have mentioned this series called the Iron Druid Chronicles, and so I think I might check that one out. So it seems similar, like it's instead of it being the wizard, you know, like Dresden is. This guy is like a one of the last druids. And so it's got some sort of different, almost Celtic mythology and stuff like that.
Druish princesses.
Yeah, that's right. and their hair dryers. Yeah,
that's right.
So thanks so much for all the suggestions for that. And keep them coming. If you have some suggestions for books that I might enjoy, I really do appreciate that. Is that the rundown?
That was a nice meaty rundown. Well done.
Meaty indeed.
If you need some answers, there's a way to find them by yourself. Everything you need to know is sitting right there on the bookshelf. Take a look inside a place that's full of wonder and surprise. You will find a whole new world will open up before your eyes.
Your library.
Everything you need to know.
Your library.
That's the place you need to go.
Your library.
All right, guys, it's time for the big deal. And this is a big deal for us because when John and I first got started in podcasting, one of the shows we watched on a regular basis was Board Games with Scott featuring Scott Nicholson. And based on our discussion a few episodes ago about gaming in public places and specifically gaming in libraries, John has expressed what I consider to be the everyman position, where he just doesn't get it.
The lack of intelligence
and
position.
And it's not a bad thing. But yeah, so we thought, and many of you listeners suggested this, we brought on the man himself, Scott Nicholson, to discuss gaming in libraries and how it is relevant today. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Hi there. It's great to be here. I've been listening to your show from the beginning, since you were truly common men, and now you've become uncommon men, and watched your growth into fame and fortune, and listened to how everyone comes and bows at the feet of Cody and John. So it's been interesting to watch your growth into power.
I've not received the checks yet. So.
No, I don't know.
those don't come.
Oh.
I always had the wrong address or something. But.
That's right.
But we're so glad to have you on the show, Scott. And we just wanted to start off just anybody who listens to our show probably I'm making an assumption here, but probably listens to some other gaming podcasts as well. And so I'm going to make the big assumption that a lot of folks have heard of who you are, but may not have had a chance to hear about maybe your background and how you got into gaming. And so we're just going to kind of pick your brain, if you don't mind. If you could just tell us, you know, how did you get started in gaming? You know, what is your background in gaming? And what's your background as a librarian?
All right, so gaming has actually been my primary hobby ever since I was a young lad. I grew up in rural Oklahoma on a horse farm, and I always liked to get board games. I was always fascinated with board games. This was back in, you know, the 70s and 80s, so they were those high-quality American-style roll the die and move along the track. Although there was a few good ones that snuck in. I still have my copy of Scotland Yard that I got back in those ages when it was put out in the U.S., so there were still some interesting ones that came out. But for the most part, I had the games, but I didn't have anyone to play the games with because I was in a rural location. So I would set up the games and play them by myself and explore them that way. Then I sort of segued into video gaming with the Atari 2600, and then programming and computer gaming with the TRS-80 Color Computer Model 1.
Ooh. I think my phone probably has more, and I don't even have a smartphone, probably has more power than that one, huh?
Oh, that computer had 4K.
Ooh, nice.
Blistering 4K.
That's right. It had a cassette drive that you had to use to load the programs on and off if you wanted to actually play something. So got started with both digital gaming and analog gaming at that point. I did role-playing gaming in high school. In college, I moved into doing some live-action role-playing, which I know I've talked with you guys before. About that was something that, and you know, that LARPing actually really changed me and who I was and helped me to come out of my shell. So the person that I am today is actually due to getting involved with LARPing and that sort of interactive theater experience.
Now, did you do what style of LARPing did you do? Was it more just the conversational style, or was it the
boffer LARP?
I did boffer LARP. I was padded weapon out in the woods, hitting people with it, shouting lightning bolt.
Nice.
So I was the full immersive. That's how I learned to sew, making costumes. So that's something I did through a lot of college, and also at that point stumbled into a game shop and found this game called Adel Verpflichtet, which has been re-released as Hoity Toity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first of the German-style games. So I was actually involved with the Dallas Board Gaming Group when Settlers came on the scene, and El Grande and Tigris and Euphrates and these things. And I remember not thinking much of Settlers because it came out just alongside all these other games. So for me, it wasn't anything special. It was just one more Euro game that was okay.
Hey, that's how
that
we feel
too. And so that really got me involved in seeing what board games, taking that sort of childhood fascination I had with board games, but then adding some games that were actually interesting and had short player turns and a lot of interaction. I have a really eclectic mix of preferences with my board games. You know, recently there was this poll for podcasters to talk about which of the top 10 games, rate the top 10 games from Board Game Geek. Mm-hmm. And I wrote back and said, well, my problem with this is there's not five of these games that I like. So I said, well, can I give you four and a maybe? You know?
Yeah, I had kind of the same issue with that as well. So
we ended up having nearly identical lists, John, I think.
Oh, really?
Because I submitted mine in the second wave, but yeah. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, because of all of those games that were on there, I think like you, Scott, I think there's maybe three or four that I even considered decent. Yeah. So
Most of them I don't even want to touch with a 10-foot pole most of the time.
Yeah, I think the words I used was, these are games I will actively avoid playing.
You know? Dodge through the hallways.
Well, it's interesting because it seems like the Board Game Geek community, which, you know, a lot of the podcast guilds reside on there, and so it's a very active part of what we do as board game podcasters. That it's still a very very focused and kind of almost laser focused sometimes subsection of gaming as a whole, and you know, really seems to cater to one specific section, and yet at the same time the rankings seem to mean something to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing I've really liked your show about is that you do talk about the spectrum of game types, that you do hit on the spectrum of at least face-to-face gaming. Yeah, and so that matches with that. I like to explore the wide variety of face-to-face games. I also explore digital games and enjoy digital game podcasts as well. The gaming, as I talk a lot, what I'm doing now, I'm actually at MIT for this academic year as a visiting scholar, and I spend a lot of time talking with people here about the idea that it's not about the game, it's about the game experience. It's about the combination of the game plus the players plus the context where that game is played. And that's what you're doing. As a game creator, you're facilitating an experience. And that experience could be facilitated through something that you do face-to-face or through something that you do digitally. But it's really about all those things together. So you can't really say something is a bad game. You can say it's a bad match between those players and the context where they're playing it. But even a game that Bingo, for example, as far as game design goes, Bingo is not an in-depth game, and most people would look at that and say, oh, that's a bad game. But the reality is, in the right group of people, in the right context, Bingo creates a great gaming experience.
85-year-old Bertha down at the community center, that's her top game right there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah.
And that can create a situation where you could engage with her. You know, that if you have a game that creates too much of a cognitive load, too much thinking, well, you lose that ability with engagement if you're with someone that doesn't handle that well. So something like Bingo that doesn't require a lot of cognitive load, although I've played it down at one of the local casinos here, and people will play with, you know, 36 cards at the same time, and so they can have as much cognitive load as they want. but even something like that, which you would normally look and turn up your nose as a gaming snob and say, oh, that's a bad game, that can be a lot of fun in the right context and with the right people.
Exactly. So talk a little bit about how your love of gaming that you just described has intersected with your career in library science. Is that something that started all the way from the beginning? Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so I guess my first degrees were actually in math and computer science, and so I was the computer guy for several departments.
Sorry, math and computer science?
Yep, which of course is such a natural background to libraries.
Does Oklahoma offer those degrees? Sorry.
Yes,
I had to.
Dear listeners, in case you don't know, Scott Nicholson, you got your undergrad degree at least from the University of Oklahoma. Is that correct?
And I marched with the pride of Oklahoma.
They had a wagon, John. And John,
so crimson and cream does run through my veins. I hate to say.
Well, you know, the guy with the Q-tip on his head. That guy was pretty cool. The drum major guy, like, he would sort of shuffle his feet when he came out.
That's right. And he had a weapon.
He did have a pretty amazing weapon, yeah.
Now, John's college marching band, of course, from Texas.
The show band of the Southwest,
yeah,
sir.
Whatever. You wore fringe and white cowboy hats. So
yes.
He can't be throwing stones here.
Scott, Cody
has told
me. Well,
the good thing about those outfits, you know, is you could go down to the dollar store and get the rick-a-rack to hang off of the thing, and it would just fit in quite nicely there.
See, Cody has told me that if he had lived in Texas, that he would have attended Texas A&M University and marched in that marching band.
No, there's a band.
I think that's maybe something that you and I can both get behind as a bad idea.
Actually, you know, when I was marching in the Pride, one thing at the – so for those listeners that don't know, there is a rivalry between Oklahoma and Texas.
A small one. A little bit.
Yeah, just a little one. Each year at the OU-Texas game – that's what it's called, right? That's what how we refer to it.
No, sir. That would be the Texas-OU game or War of Northern Aggression, pretty much.
Each year at the OU-Texas game, one of our things we would do as the band is we would go down and warm up in the Cotton Bowl there in Dallas. And so I played the saxophone. Saxophonists are a weird bunch. So you've got the folks playing the trumpet out there doing their push-ups and the drums out there doing laps to get warmed up. And the sax section leader said, you know what, we could do all this warm-up, but I'm going to give you all an experience you can talk about for years and years. I'm going to let you have a nap on the cotton. So I have fallen asleep on the cotton in the middle of the cotton bowl.
Really?
So, and here I am 20 years later telling the story. So thank you, random section leader. You did give me a story.
Hooray.
So anyway,
back to, yes, thanks for putting up with that.
We've chatted in email about this rivalry before.
Indeed.
So it was good to get that out. I started with my degrees in math and computer science and worked actually as a computer guy at OU for a couple years and got tired of my hobby being my job. This is important. We'll come back to this later. and so I went and had some friends who were in the library program, and they said, well, you know, Scott, with that computer background, and this was back in mid-90s, you could actually do quite well in the library field. There's a lot of use of computers going on, and it would be a good supplement. So I went into the library science field and really enjoyed helping people. It's a very much a field about helping people to achieve whatever they're trying to achieve. And so got involved and did my library degree, and then I actually went to Texas Christian University as a librarian.
Oh, wow. Go Horned Frogs, I guess.
That's right. So I was there as a reference librarian and lived in the Dallas area I worked there, and then actually went for my PhD at the University of North Texas. And that's where I did my doctorate in information science. But I did a lot of work in statistics and data mining, and then went down to Citibank as a statistician.
Wow. I never knew.
Made the rounds.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So big difference there from being a librarian to being a statistician at a large corporate bank. Not quite the place that fills you full of goodness and joy.
No. But you were playing games the whole time, right?
So the whole time, that was still a big
part of your life.
So we've had no connection here with the gaming other than, you know, knowing statistics does help you on the gaming table quite a bit.
Right.
So then decided that I wasn't a good match for corporate America and went and joined Syracuse as a professor in library and information science. And so was teaching people how to do library work. And my research was actually in assessment, helping libraries to figure out if they were doing a good job using data that's in their systems. So trying to see if there's data to help support matches between people and objects. And it was at the American Library Association conference in about 2006 that I saw a Dance Dance Revolution game being played. I thought, well, this is interesting. What's going on here? And so I chatted with them, and they talked about how libraries were using these video games as a way to bring teenagers into the library. And I looked, and they had some journals written on video games and teenagers. And I knew that gaming was actually a lot bigger than video games, and it could appeal to many more people than just teenagers. And so I spent some time thinking, am I really going to do this? Am I really going to make this jump from doing assessment of library services, good, safe field, into games and libraries? And I said, sure, let's make a difference. And so I started, that was about 2007 when I did my first big, I did a big survey where we randomly selected 400 public libraries in the U.S. and called every one of them and talked to them about how they did, if they did anything with gaming, because we needed a baseline. And we found from that study that about 75% of public libraries in the U.S. support gaming in some way.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And that was a lot higher than we had expected.
Yeah. And this kind of gets to the core of what my question was on our recent episode, is that when I think of libraries, because I went to the University of Texas, so I spent a lot of time.
They had a library there?
They had several.
Oh, very good.
And yeah, not all the books were colored in.
Okay. And so I, you know, every time I went to the library, it was a place for books, a place of study. I've always thought of it as a scholarly place. And, you know, of course I, you know, had libraries in elementary school where it was, you know, story time and that kind of stuff. But I always thought of it as just a place you go to read books, check out books, or study.
And be quiet.
Right. And so my perception of it, which is a very narrow one, how long has it been since that was the case? I mean, has this been a recent thing where things are sort of moving into this almost media center direction?
Well, it's funny you ask that. Actually, one of my other articles then was to try and trace gaming in libraries. And I started doing research going back into old newspaper records and things like that. And I traced gaming programs in libraries back to the 1850s.
Wow.
That since that time, libraries have had different forms of gaming.
It was that lady playing bingo. She was the one,
right.
I mentioned earlier.
She was right there. Well, the chess club, the oldest chess club that still meets in the United States today, started in a library in San Francisco and still meets in that library.
Wow.
So libraries have been involved with chess for a long time, chess clubs and Scrabble clubs and bridge clubs. Through the Great Depression, we began to see toy libraries come up, where public libraries would circulate games and toys for the kids. And this was actually started as a way to help teach kids good ethics and good behavior, because they could check out these games and then return them, games and toys, and check them out, return them in good shape, and get rewarded for returning things. There were these puzzle contests that got really big in the Great Depression, where people had the ability to win a lot of money, but to do the puzzle contest, they actually had to answer questions. Well, the only way at that point to get those answers was to go to the library. Hmm. And so then we started to have more, and what's happened? So you've talked about library as a place of study, and some libraries are. Libraries are there to meet the needs of the community that they support. And that's the important thing to realize. Different libraries will be different types of spaces. So in an academic library that needs to have a quiet space for students to study, that's the need they will fulfill. Some academic libraries, however, are fulfilling more of a need for groups to get together and engage with each other, have space to be noisy, you know, because there's other quiet spaces on campus. So what's happening with libraries, and what has happened ever since, you know, the public library, as we know, it's the flipping over to public. The public library, as we know it today, actually got going as a place for people to become morally better.
Huh.
The idea was that a group of people in a community said, you know, we have all of these immoral people living here, and we need to help them become morally better. So we will pool our resources to buy books. And the librarian was more of a pharmacist, a moral pharmacist at that point, and would help to get you the book you should be reading now to help you be better. And there's still traces of that came through librarianship for a long time. The idea of, do you give people what they want to read, or do you give people what they should read? Even when I was in library school in the late 1980s, that was still discussed. Do you give people what they want, or do you give people what they should have?
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of controversy in some areas about censorship in the libraries, or should X book be in this library, and
yep.
and that the library and the ALA and groups like that really fight to keep kind of that open information sort of a thing, where the library doesn't really govern what is air quote good and what is air quote bad, you know.
And it's actually, the idea is that while the libraries and while the profession of librarianship is about providing open access to information, the reality is the library is there to support the needs and the viewpoints of a specific community. So there's typically a library board that is made up of members of that community that help to step in, and the librarian can turn to them and say, well, how does this work that one person wants to have removed? How does this fit within the ethics of our community? Is this appropriate? Librarians will usually be on the side of keeping the materials in the library, but the reality is they are reporting financially, they're reporting to a larger body. And that's almost universal for libraries, are always supporting a larger body, and that's where what they do come from. So what you talk about with, libraries, they're just a place for reading and quiet and all of this. What's funny is if you go back in time, you started with library being this place for ethical stuff. Well, then all of a sudden, this fiction began to creep in. These penny dreadfuls, these romance, cheap romance novels. How dare we have these things in the library? The library is not a place for fiction.
Yeah, Trouble in River City.
That's right. So what's funny is you can trace this same concept forward through time. You can see libraries begin to bring in music. Music? We shouldn't have records in the library. Library is a place for books. Then videos. Movies? Why does the library have movies? That's not right. Now, actually, DVD checkouts is one of the biggest things in most public libraries. Mm-hmm. It's a very popular, and it's meeting a demand of that community. So games are really just a natural extension of a form of media that people want to engage with that the library is choosing to support.
This is very, very interesting to me, and this idea of libraries being noisier places, I'm sort of starting to understand this. Now, my church actually meets in the Central Library in downtown Indianapolis, which was just recently renovated in the last 5 years or so. $10 million renovation. They took the old library building and put this giant silver spaceship-looking thing on the back of it. They added a 300-seat auditorium, which is where our church meets, and then there's also all of these meeting rooms, including a very cool room called the Think Tank that has all these curved walls that are made out of dry erase board material. The entire room is dry erase board. And they have great, cool programs, and it's great meeting spaces. And I went to an event a couple of weeks ago, because the auditorium, when they're not doing our church, which is just about the only thing that happens regularly, there's all these different musical events and poetry readings and movies that are played in there. And they have this group. And Scott, I think you would really like it. So if you get a chance, and listeners, check this out on Facebook or online, a group called Muka Patsa. Have you ever heard of them, Scott?
Nope.
So Muka Patsa is basically, they describe themselves as a little marching band. And it's literally all of these folks that are exceptional musicians. It's about 30 of them, and they're led by this kind of tall and grizzly-looking man playing the sousaphone, and they are like a punk rock marching band. And so they started their show outside of the library, like, which is right down the middle of downtown, and marched all the way inside and circled all of the people that were listening. I mean, making a huge racket and just beautiful music, but just really, really loud. And then marched into the auditorium and did this great 1 hour long show of just all this really great music. And I, the whole time I'm sitting there really enjoying this and thinking, I can't believe we're in a library. So my paradigm is shifting slowly about all this kind of stuff.
Oh, many public libraries now, rather than being quiet spaces with a special room to be loud, are loud spaces with a special room to be quiet.
Oh, I think that's a cool transition too. And so it's kind of moving forward in this vein here, the idea of having gaming in libraries. You know, let's say a listener out there is interested in, this sounds great, libraries are a place for games. I had no idea. If someone was interested in doing some sort of gaming thing at a library, how would they go about doing that? Is it something where, you know, just take your copy of Descent and just go to the library and see if you can find someone to play with? Or
that's an ambitious first game to bring into the library.
That's right.
That's the first one that came to mind. How exactly you're very well-versed in library gaming programs. How does it all work?
Well, different types of libraries have different types of gaming programs. So I told you about that first survey that we did, but then I started doing an annual census where I put out the call to say, any library that's done gaming in the last year, please tell me about it. Tell me what type of library you are and what you did and why and what difference it made. That's a lot of what we want to look at, is how did this gaming make a difference in your community? And so what I found is, there's four major library types. You've got public libraries, you've got academic libraries with which like a college or that kind of institution. You've got school libraries, which are like a K-12. And then special libraries. Those would be like law libraries or medical libraries, any sort of small corporate library. And each of these library types, there's some form of gaming involved. So the first thing to know is you need to know what kind of gaming programs will be appropriate for the type of library you want to talk with. So in an academic library, a college library, the two times they tend to use gaming are either as a thing at the start of the semester as a way to get new students engage with each other and engage with librarians and engage with the library. One library in Texas actually did a pretty cool murder mystery in the library where all of the librarians were suspects, and your dossiers were like the hours the librarian worked, what they did, what their specialties were, and you use that to deduce the mystery. Well, the cool thing about that is by playing the game, you then learn who are the librarians, what do they do, when are they around, who can I ask about what.
I like that.
Yeah.
And so the other side then with academic libraries is they will run end of semester stress relief programs. So a Guitar Hero contester, or that's when you could do a live scale descent through the stacks, you know.
Now you're talking. That,
yeah, see, I think, see, okay, to divert for 1 second, one reason why I love listening to your show is you talk about True Dungeon. I've never been able to do a True Dungeon. I so much want to do a True Dungeon because I did all this live action stuff. I've never been able to get to one. So each year I have really enjoyed listening to your description of the True Dungeon experience.
We've got a spot for you when you come to the gaming capital of the world and attend Gen Con. We have a spot in our group waiting for you.
Yeah.
I've been to Gen Con once before when it was in Milwaukee and had a good time. I'd like to come back again, and now that I've got some game designs that might actually roll out here in the U.S., it'd be pretty exciting to go down and see my games in action.
You'll definitely have to look us up then.
Yeah, and so that's academic libraries. In school libraries, there's two types of gaming that goes on. One type is within the classroom. So the librarian is helping the teachers come up with games to work in the classroom. Now, this is an area actually where a person knowledgeable about board games could make a pretty big impact. Brian Mayer and Chris Harris, who are two people that play these Euro games, they've got a book called Libraries Got Game, and they talk about real games that the authentic games, like the games we play, and what curricular topics they're best used in. So like bringing in The Making of the President, 1960, into a civics class and running it with the whole class, where the whole class takes sides and the sides have to debate what to do, and running that over a semester, doing it like on Fridays for an hour a day. Their book will help someone come up with some great ideas where they say, hey, I could come in and help run these topically appropriate games for your class, and it could make a difference. The other way that school libraries use games is through an after-school program or a before-school program or an at-lunch program as a chance for the kids who are gamers, who may not be as socially engaged with other kids, to come together and be geeks together and be a place where it's okay to like games. And it's okay to geek out about games. And it's been a place where these kids can really come out of their shell because you're giving them, as you know, many times in schools, you can have kids are not necessarily kind to the geeks. Having a safe space where you can geek out. And what's funny is I reflect back upon my high school in rural Oklahoma, and there were four of us that used to go into the library at lunch each day and play King's Quest on the IBM. In fact, to the point where the library actually held a King's Quest competition to see who could get the furthest in half an hour, you know? And so those are the two things in school libraries.
Yeah, that was sorry to cut you off there for a second.
Go ahead.
That was my public school experience in high school. That's where we, at lunchtime, we would go to the library. We would play, this was a small rural high school as well. We would play Magic the Gathering and D&D. I mean, obviously very small D&D things, but, you know, and the librarians were kind of our buddies. You know, they were... Not to say they were like the protectors or whatever thing, but you know, it was
the guardians
this,
of the
was,
geeks.
Well, it was like Scott was saying, it was this nice little bubble where we could really be ourselves. So the libraries are cool.
And that's something, you know, that's a lot of people, when they think about gaming in libraries, they focus only on the video games. They don't reflect back to say, well, you know, there actually is this past in public libraries. One of the heaviest attended public library programs is the summer reading program. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my kids love ours. Yeah, it's all the prizes involved and everything.
Now, how do they get the prizes?
They have to read a certain number of pages, I think.
Okay, so they actually have a goal and they are tracking things. Mm-hmm. So perhaps your kids have actually been playing games in libraries for years.
Oh, wow. He really flipped that one on me.
And wearing out my wife, because summer reading is a very busy time. She's a children's librarian. So.
It is the big one. But summer reading games embedded in that summer reading program, have been going on for a very long time. And that's been part of what's gone on with the games in libraries. But then also, so you've got the difference between, I talk about gaming activities in libraries and game collections in libraries. So our research found that about 40% of public libraries ran some sort of gaming program where you came to the library and played a game. About 20% of libraries had some sort of gaming collection where you could actually circulate a game and take it home.
Wow.
A lot of my study has been focused on the playing the game in the library space. So our libraries have started regular gaming activities. Now, a lot of them have started with video games and teenagers, because the number of people, if you look at when people don't come to the library, so when they're little kids, they come to the library, then they get a little bit older, and they get, can you guess what point they get not coming to the library anymore? Can you guess what activity they get too tired of?
I would say reading.
Well, when they get too tired of story time.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Then they stop coming. Now,
once they get
story
cool.
time, that's right. Story time is where you get together a big group of kids and the librarian tells a story. Now, does the story really matter in story time?
No.
It's not about the story. It's about the experience. It's about the social engagement of the kids with each other and the social engagement of the parents with each other. When the kids get too old for story time, then libraries are figuring out, if we take away the experience where someone tells you the story, but instead we give you an experience where you get to make the story up with other people through games, you have the same activity.
That sounds like role-playing games.
Role-playing games or board games or really any sort of any game. I argue that games are a form of interactive storytelling. Now, that theme may not be very deep, but it's a way that you and others are entering into a magic circle, is the term they use in game scholarship. We're entering into this space where we're going to agree to suspend the rules of the reality, and we're going to tell a story with each other. And we're going to facilitate that story with a game, role-playing game, board game, card game, video game, whatever. We're engaging with each other. And so you have the same thing. You have the experience for the kids to engage with each other. You have the experience for the parents to engage with each other. And you can even have the kids and parents engaging together around these games.
So what about when we get to the grown up stage now? So if you have you know, your average Joe, he's got a job, he's got a bunch of games he'd really like to play him. He doesn't have a group,
doesn't have a good place to play them regularly.
Right? Could, you know, can a library help with that?
So probably the best thing to do in that case is I would suggest to go to your local library, to tell them about what you're interested in, that you like these games, and that you'd like to start a gaming group in the library. Many libraries have meeting spaces that you could use. You talked about this large auditorium. And in public libraries, the general rule is that if they allow anyone to use the meeting space, they allow anyone to use the meeting space. Some libraries will choose to put rules, but they govern everyone. Most libraries are open, though, and it comes down to who books the space. Some might have a small charge. Or you can say, hey, I'd like to run a gaming group here. Can I set up somewhere in the library? Are there some tables that aren't an area that's not heavily used that I could set up? And so this can be a way to get started with gaming in libraries. Now, the good thing is that if the librarian looks like, oh, I don't understand this, there's several things that you could do. One, here's the big plug. I wrote a book called Everyone Plays at the Library for librarians that go through the wide variety of gaming types and help them understand how they could use games in the libraries. So one thing you could do is actually point the librarian to that book, or even buy a copy of the book and give it to the librarian and say, I want to do this. Here's a great guide to start. Now, if you don't want to spend money, you can go. I did a class in YouTube 2 years ago, a free class that I taught as a class in library school. Students took it for credit. It was put on YouTube. It's 30 videos long. Each video runs between 20 and 40 minutes. And the whole thing's free, and it's at gamesinlibraries.org/course. You could point the librarian to view the first few of those videos, because in those videos, I'm really speaking libraryese. You know, it's where I take the gaming banter and translate it into what a librarian needs to hear.
Ooh, will the uneducated people like me who didn't know about libraries until now, would they be able to understand your course?
I would actually say that,
sir.
That you will probably be pretty bored through the first five episodes, because the first five episodes are Gaming 101. Mm. And then after that, it starts to bring in some conceptual models and talk about. But what it's going to do, if you're interested in thinking about games like a library has to, the videos will help you realize what the librarian has to think about. That, you know how earlier I talked about the gaming experience, mm-hmm. that's the match between the players, the game, and the context? Mm-hmm. Well, libraries have to facilitate that. And it's the same thing as running a good game group. Someone who runs a good game group, they know that their job of running that group is not to sit down and beat the pants off of every new person that comes along. They know their job is to facilitate a good gaming experience for the other players, even if it means they lose. That they put their own winning and losing to the side and say, I'm going to facilitate a good experience for these people, because that way they'll come back and they'll be interested and they'll get engaged.
So it's kind of a secondary question. So this assumes that one wants to go to a library and kind of start up a maybe like a recurring gaming group that's, you know, sponsored by the library and you know, they want to attract new people to. Would you say that's correct?
Well, that's one route, or that you just have a group and you want a place to meet.
Yeah, that was my second question, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where these, again, as we talked earlier, with libraries, many libraries are supporting more and more group work because students are getting more and more group work, so they need smaller spaces to do this stuff, and reserving one of those rooms for gaming, or just asking, hey, is there a table that we could sit down and play a game at?
Sure.
What smart libraries do is, so let's say that you are showing up and you're meeting with a group of people once a week and you're doing your gaming. The smart librarian then says, hey, I want to run a big gaming event for the public on Saturday. Would you all be willing to help me with that event? There's actually a chapter in my book called The Gamers, which talk about how to engage your local gamers and get them involved with helping to run this stuff.
Excellent. Well, this has been absolutely eye-opening for me, and I know I must have come across as a total goob these last couple episodes, like I'm just completely uneducated. But this.
Well, we can educate the Texans. It's okay.
Okay.
not that there's any correlation, and not that there's anything about causation and correlation here. But,
says the guy who has 2 degrees from schools in Texas.
So there's one other way to get involved, and I do want to plug this. So National Gaming Day at your library. runs every year. It's been running now for 3 years. The fourth is coming up. It's November 12th this year. It's always on a Saturday. The goal of National Gaming Day at your library is to get as many people going to libraries and playing games as possible. In the last few years, we have gotten about 30,000 people on a Saturday to show up at libraries and play games. We've had sponsorship in the past by Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast. This year, it's Family Party Games. FamilyandPartyGames.com is our sponsor. They did the Loaded Question game and some other games, and they are giving thousands of copies of these games to libraries. What I would suggest, if someone's interested in trying this out and wants to have a good excuse to say, look, thousands of other libraries are doing it, talk to your local library and help point them to, it's NGD for National Gaming Day, ngd.ala.org has the place where they can sign up. They can sign up to get free games. There will be some national video game tournaments as well as board game events. And it can be a great way to start the discussion, to say, hey, let's be a part of National Gaming Day. It's sponsored by the American Library Association. So it can actually give a lot of oomph to an individual trying to argue why the library should try this, if they can point to this national movement that we got started to say, look, there's a bunch of other people doing it. Let's give it a shot.
Very outstanding. Cool. We will put a link to that in the show notes. And Scott, we just want to thank you for coming on. Like we said, you're one of the gaming podcasting heroes in our book. We have your trading card. So
that's right. We'll get signed someday. Right?
That's how I should have made all my money, with podcaster playing cards.
Man, those business ideas, it you know, that's right. Sometimes it takes a while for them to come to fruition.
Yeah, we're not too good at it, the whole, you know, giving away lots of effort for free. We didn't quite figure that
no. out. Hey, well,
it's been a lot of fun to talk with you guys. I've enjoyed your show. I really have listened to it since the beginning. Because your approach of, hey, we're the common fellows talking about gaming. I've enjoyed the wide spectrum of games you talk about, and I hope you continue that. That's cool stuff. I would be honored to do a true dungeon run with you, and all of us die together on some silly puzzle that we can't figure out the solution to or something like that. And if you're ever in Boston and you want a true dungeon-like experience, there's actually a playhouse called Five Wits, and they do, running all the time, those sort of live puzzle-type things. There was one I went into that was a pyramid. Now one's called 20,000 Leagues, where you're like a submarine that's going down and people have to run around and solve puzzles. They do another one called Espionage. But if you like that kind of true dungeon-y thing and you want to do it in Boston, there's actually a place to do it all the time.
I'm going
to
check that out.
Wow. you New England listeners, check that out, definitely.
Yeah. Hey, and I'm not affiliated with them. I'm just a
fan. Scott, while we still got you here, what have you been playing lately that you like that's been interesting for you?
Well, what's funny is, so I do a blog on Board Game Geek called Get Off My Lawn. Get off my lawn, kids! Where I started grousing about when games, there was some sort of issue I took with some element of the design or something like that. And as I did this blog, I realized that most of the new games I played, I didn't like. I said, you know, out of every 10 new games I'd play, I'd maybe like one of them. And the others I would just be like, eh, you know, something else did it better. And I realized that. And so I said, you know, maybe I'm just going to play games that I know I like for a while. And so my number of new games that I've played has really gone down. And I've been focusing more on pulling out some of the old games and having good gaming experiences. So people groused at me about not having that blog updated. And my response was, well, that's because I'm playing games I know I like. I'm tired. And it's been nice. It's been nice to go back to some of this, you know, to pull out Acquire again, to play Battlestar Galactica, to play Small World, Puerto Rico, play these things again and enjoy them. Rather than always chasing the new, that's been a nice shift.
So you mentioned Bingo earlier. That wasn't just a coincidence, was it? You've been playing a lot of Bingo, haven't you?
What was funny is, so my partner and I were at a bingo hall at a casino playing Bingo, and the woman next to him said, "Dear, I think you have Bingo." And he said, "Oh, I do, Bingo," and won $500.
Oh,
and, you know,
wow! Kindness of strangers, right there.
Did you give her a tip, maybe?
Did we know?
No. Okay. Nope. There's a gamer right there.
That's right. But we thanked her profusely. So, So anyway, and you know, and it's about, I try to figure out, well, what's the good experience? What's the game that's going to facilitate a good experience for us? And a lot of times that's not the new and shiny, because part of it is you don't know what kind of experience it's going to facilitate.
That's true.
And so, but so I've been revisiting a lot of old stuff, enjoying that. I played Roads and Boats again recently, and that was interesting. I did play Rune Age today. So at this lab where I'm at a lab, a game lab called the Gambit, the Singapore MIT Gambit Game Lab. And so part of what we do each week is we play games and then we dissect them. So today we played the new collectible card game Rune Age and sort of tore it apart a little bit. And we're pretty disappointed in general with it. Felt it was like, well, there's a few interesting things here, but it's not quite done yet.
Wow, that sounds exactly like our opinion of it too. So
you know, there's some interesting stuff there, but it was like it felt like, well, we kind of played the game for half of it, and then we just kind of waited for it to end.
Always a great experience when you're just trying to run out the clock on a game.
Sounds like our game of Talisman last week.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep. Yeah.
Well, Scott, before we let you go, whenever we have a guest on the show, we always have to subject them to something we call the Final Five.
Oh, dear.
All right, it is time to subject, dare I say, Dr. Scott Nicholson.
You don't have to dare say it. He's a doctor.
Oh, I'm doing it. Right. To the Final Five. John, number one.
All right, number. Are you ready? Are you ready, Dr. Nicholson?
Let me seatbelt myself in here, and I think I'm ready to go.
All right, you may answer these questions in any way that you see fit, because we know that we give these... Well, just answer it however you like. We get some fiddly answers sometimes, and that's okay. Number one, what is your favorite game of all time?
My favorite game... is going to be whatever game is best for the players in the context that we're in.
There it is.
There is an appropriately fiddly answer. Very nice.
That's right.
We'll mark you down for Monopoly.
Okay.
That's fine. I've got the videos out there showing my love. I've been on national TV showing my love of Monopoly.
Oh, that's true. All right. You'll be ready for question five then.
That generated mail.
Okay. All right. Question number two.
Scott, what is your least favorite game?
Should I give the fiddly answer again?
Whatever is least appropriate for the number of people in the contest.
There you go. It is my least favorite game is when someone forces a game that is not appropriate for the players at the table or the context of the game and creates a very bad gaming experience.
Okay, that's fair answer.
Put you down for Agricola then. Agricola.
That sometimes can be my least favorite game. If you're trying to play that in a bar with a small table after having three beers, that's probably not a good gaming. Well, it can be a great experience that may not be at all related to Agricola.
Agricola. Diet Agricola.
That's right.
Question number three.
All right. You kind of expounded on this a little bit in our discussion, but what is the best thing about playing games?
Well, the bestest thing about playing games for me is the chance to escape. The chance to explore another place, to explore other people and explore relationships in different ways. Because of that magic circle concept where we're agreeing to enter the magic circle, where we're agreeing to say, you know, we're all going to put aside whatever we're carrying in life and we're going to engage with each other, that can be a wonderful and freeing thing to do. And we don't get many situations to do that in life.
I'm totally going to do that next time. Great answer, by the way. I'm totally going to do that next time that I have a game event. I'm going to say, guys, let's enter the magic circle. Come on in.
The magic circle.
I will force you into the magic circle.
The circle is closed.
2 minute in or 1 minute late. Number four.
All right, Scott, if you could play, if you had to play one game for the rest of your life to the exclusion of all others, what would that game be?
With the addendum that you cannot say the most acceptable game with the number of people.
It has to be one game.
I have a real game for this one. That would be my favorite game I will always suck at, unless I did this, and that's Go.
Oh, okay.
Go, I am impressed and amazed with the game. I will always be awful at it. Every time I look at it and try to understand it more, it opens up new depths. And so if I were to jettison everything, Go would be the game that I could play for a lifetime and still find interesting things to explore, assuming you had someone of equal skill level, which is the problem with Go.
I have never played it.
I haven't either.
Well, there we go. Okay, we go.
Since you two have never played it, playing it with each other would actually be the thing to do, because the one problem with Go is if you play with someone who is slightly better than you, you will lose. Hmm. And even though there's a handicapping system, it does not. It's you know, this pure abstract, and it's such that it's much better to enjoy the exploration when you're with someone else who's new at it and you kind of explore the space.
John loves abstract strategy games, so we'll be pulling that out soon.
I'll give it a go.
You give it a go. Very nice. All right, and finally, question number 5.
All right, Scott Nicholson, Monopoly, great board game or greatest board game?
With the right people the right context, it's a fantastic game. It is the best game in certain situations. In other situations, it's a very poor choice. But whatever you do, stop putting money on free parking.
Preach it, brother. Preach it.
I gave the opening colloquium about board games here at MIT, and I talked about that. I said, stop it! Yep. No matter what you do, you've just added an hour onto the game.
Yep. I'm not beating the drum of Monopoly or anything. I don't think it's that great of a game, but if you play it by the rules, it's not as bad as people think.
That's right.
And if it's in the right context, and that context would be, for example, you sit down with a group of people, they all know Monopoly well, you're willing to play by the rules, you've got appropriate, enjoyable beverages and some time to kill, and you don't want to have to think too hard, it can be an appropriate choice.
Sure. Although if you've got a lot of people together that know Monopoly real well, it seems like they would all make the decision to play something else.
Oh, geez.
Well, if you play it with everything, a lot of people don't realize Monopoly has auction elements. It has trading elements. If you actually look at all the elements, it's set collection.
Worker placement. It's a good cooperative. It's got some deck building, right?
It really does have. I mean, if you turn Monopoly into a trading game and set collection game, you can actually end it a lot faster because you start trading toward those monopolies. So here I am after going on national TV and telling Mo Rocca I hate Monopoly. Here I am talking about how it can be a good choice. So to take your silly question and make it serious, sometimes it is the best choice.
Well, and actually on the line right now, we have Mo Rocca. No, just kidding. Well, Scott. Well, we just loved having you on the show here. Thank you so much for joining us. And take care. We really appreciate you being here.
All right, thank you very much, and hope to see many of you. Are you guys going to go to Board Game Geek Con?
I will not be able to make it this year. I made it last year, and I wasn't able to get the flights and vacation worked out. But we will be up in New Hampshire the weekend of October the 16th for the Extra Life charity game event at Myriad Games. So I know you're down in Boston, so if you were able
to... And actually, I've been to the Myriad Game Shop. It was one of the few shops I walked in, and they had a copy of Tulip Mania on the shelf.
We saw it
sold.
There last time we were there.
Of course.
Yep.
And so that I actually took a picture with it.
Did you sign it?
Actually, the person who was there did not seem to have any idea who I was, nor did he care, so I chose not to push it. But I took a nice picture with it, and that same copy is probably still sitting on the shelf, to be fair.
we'll check when we're there.
We'll check when we're there, yeah.
There you go. All right.
All right, well, Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you all.
All right.
You're listening to Game On with Cody and John. We're just like the Dice Tower, but with 100% less Tom Vassell.
All right, as we mentioned earlier, one of our sponsors for the month of September is Clever Mojo Games. These are the guys that made the Kickstarter hit Alien Frontiers, and they're building on the success of that game with its first expansion, Alien Frontiers Factions.
That's right, and Clever Mojo Games is kind of returning to where it all started for them, Kickstarter.com, and they've been raising funding for their new Factions expansion all throughout the month of September, and that funding period is going to end, I think, right at the end of this month. So if you're listening to this in the month of September, you still have an opportunity to get in on this. And we'll go ahead and tell you that it's been hugely successful already, and it's already funded, which means that it's going to be funded, the game is going to be produced, and so now it's just an opportunity to build more and more funds to make the production even better, and you know, so you can still get in on this.
And you can get a little something out of it. I mean, they have a lot of great perks for getting on the bandwagon and being one of their sponsors.
Exactly. And some of their levels even include, you know, copies of the base game of Alien Frontiers, which they'll ship earlier. So the Factions expansion comes out in March. That's the scheduled date. But you could get a regular copy of Alien Frontiers, I believe, in October or November. So, you know, that's a great perk, too. So let's talk just a little bit about the Factions expansion for the game. Cody and I haven't had an opportunity to play a prototype of this game. And this is one of those expansions that sort of got... it expands the base game in four different areas, and it's almost kind of a cafeteria plan expansion.
My favorite kind of expansion, the a la carte ones. Seriously. Yeah.
The spaghetti mixed right. in together with the
Jello with the chunks of fruit
I
in
love
it.
That Fantastic. Stuff, yeah. But it's going to expand the game in four ways. You have faction boards, which are going to give each player a unique benefit, and it provides like new orbital facilities and with new functions that all players can access. So the idea is that you have a board in front of you where you can put dice, but also other players can put dice there too, and you'll get a special benefit for having that special ability. And so it's just more places for you to be able to put your dice, and they're dealt out in sort of a draft format at the beginning of the game, and so it's a good way to have completely different replayability in the game. You're going to have agenda cards, which will...
My favorite of all of them.
This was very cool, yeah. And this provides the opportunity for surprise victory points during the game. One thing about Alien Frontiers is that the scoring track is always visible, and so you can always see kind of where you're standing in the game, and everything's sort of open information. But the hidden agendas are going to add a little bit of a twist to that, where each hidden agenda card is going to have two kinds of points on it. There are points that you can earn mid-game, and if you meet the condition for those points, you can turn the card over and say, ta-da, I did that cool thing, here, and you know, you get points for it. Or you can there's another section of the card that has a different kind of condition that you would reveal at the end of the game. So you have sort of to make the decision as to whether do you want to get those points right away, or do you want to try for the other condition and get them at the end. And so I think that's kind of a cool thing. It's real straightforward in the base game to know, well, you're trying to get things onto the planet so that you can get points. But when the hidden agendas are going on, you might see people doing goofy things. You don't know why are they doing that exactly, and that might be the reason. There's eight new alien tech cards in the game that are going to be new ways to bend the game rules and to advance your plans. You can earn or burn resources in new ways. You can hijack your opponent's ships. That's kind of cool. And you can also... just all kinds of things. Gaze into alternate realities and piggyback and FTL drive to one of your ships. You know, very exciting things that you can add on to your ships. And it also will include, this is the fourth part of it, it'll include purple dice and colonies for a fifth player to play.
People have been asking about that since Alien Frontiers first came out.
It seems like any game that's too... 2 to 4 players, there's always people start begging for a fifth player. Mm-hmm. And so this expansion will allow you to do a fifth player. And the expansion will come with actually a full set of scoring rockets for all for all colors. So if you missed out on that with the base game, you're going to be able to get scoring markers for all of them from the previous promo packs. So anyway, gamers can you guys can pledge your support to this Factions expansion on the Kickstarter page now through September 30th. Retailers can join in via Springboard powered by Gamesalute.com, and that's going to run for 30 days after the Kickstarter campaign closes. So you still have time to get on this. If you're listening to this in September, you can definitely get on board and get that brand new expansion to your table. So
it's a lot of fun. We've played it, and you got to pick it up if you're a fan of Alien Frontiers. This feels like a really natural extension of that game. It doesn't feel tacked on. You can tell they've put a lot of thought into this one, so definitely consider giving it your support today.
Yep, and while you're at it, if you go back and listen to our previous episode where we talked about Sunrise City, another brand new board game coming from Clever Mojo Games, that Kickstarter campaign also has been funded, which means you know it's going to be triggered, and you still have an opportunity in the month of September to get in on that game as well. So lots of great stuff coming from Clever Mojo, and we want to thank Clever Mojo for supporting Game On with Cody and John.
It's time for Buy, Try, or Deny, and we have one that has been very prevalent on BGG for a while. It's been, you know, ever since kind of teaser images were first posted out there. This game has received a lot of attention, and it's another Kickstarter baby, and it is Eminent Domain from Tasty Minstrel Games. Of all the minstrels, they're the tastiest, from what I've heard.
Yes, indeed.
9 out of 10 minstrels agree. Here's the review of Eminent Domain.
I got nothing.
That was a lead-in.
That was very nice. Thank you. So, Eminent Domain is designed by Seth Jaffe, and this is a game that I got a chance to play at Board Game Geek Con last year in a prototype form.
Look at you.
Yeah, and Seth actually taught me the game. Yeah, ooh. So me and Marian Ravindra Prasad played with me. So.
Say that five times.
Podcasting darlings themselves. So, anyway, so this game it's been called a lot of things, and a lot of people have said that it's a deck-building game. Some have said it's like a Race for the Galaxy clone. Some have said it's the next step in deck-building games. Well, it's a lot of different things. They call it a deck-building strategy game, and for those of you who don't like deck-building games, don't let this scare you off, because I think the deck-building element of this is kind of downplayed a little bit.
Secondary at best.
Yeah, I don't think this is the main thing that's going on in this game. I think it's just more of a side effect of what happens. If anything, it's sort of like an Empire Engine sort of building game. The idea, it's mainly a card game. There's a little board that sits in the middle, but it's essentially a card game. And the idea is that you're trying to get the most victory points. What they call them prestige points, I believe, in this game. And they're nice little stars to denote those. And you're going to do that by surveying planets, which are all represented by cards. You're basically playing like space explorers. And you're going to be surveying those planets. You're going to be settling those planets, either by colonizing them or by using military strength to overtake them, to attack them. And then once you have those planets under your control, then you can produce resources on those planets, and then you can trade those resources in for victory points. At the same time, you can research new technologies, which will help you to do things more efficiently and faster. And if you research even more advanced technologies, then those might give you some victory points at the end of the game. But that's the essential elements of what you're trying to do. And it's all going to be mediated by the play of just a few different cards. There's really only five different kinds of cards in this game. Six if you count all the different technology cards. Those have some variety to them. But everyone's going to start off with the same sort of deck of cards. And let me just tell you about these cards. When I played the prototype for this game, the artwork on the cards, of course, screen printed, and it's just, you know, something just printed out from someone's computer and just to get the gameplay down. But with all the money that they got from Kickstarter, this is one of the most successful Kickstarter, if not the most successful Kickstarter campaign to the date when it was done. I think Glory to Rome might have done a little bit more.
I think the initial Alien Frontiers was like 290%.
Oh, okay.
But this one's up there. This is one of the best ones.
Yeah, this raised like, I think, $50,000 or $60,000, something like that. And so they definitely spent their money and got some really nice artwork. And Cody, you can always speak to the artwork more than I can.
I'm going to mention this later in the buy points, but some of the best card layout and art I've seen in years in a game. Just gorgeous.
Very clear and to understand what's going on.
I love iconography, and they do it right.
So there's five main kinds of cards in this game. There's the survey card, warfare, colonize. There's a card called a produce / trade card, and then a research card. Everyone is going to start off the game with the same deck of cards. So much like a Dominion or any other kind of deck building game, you're going to get two of each card, except you get only one warfare card. And then you get a card called the politics card, which there's only four of those in the whole game. You give one to each player. And then that card will leave the game during the course of the game. It's a 2-4 player game. You're going to start off with those cards, and you're going to shuffle them up, and then you're going to deal yourself five cards, and that's your starting hand. This sounds like a lot of other games that start off the same way. In the center of the table is a board, and then that's where there's going to be stacks of cards for each of these kinds of cards. So, and then depending on the number of players, you may play with a different number of cards. I think that's the case. I can't remember now. But I think that if you play with less players, you might play with less cards.
Makes sense.
Something like that.
Only the best here at Game On.
Oh, I know. So the way the game flow is going to work is the turn will consist of three steps: an action phase, a roll phase, and a cleanup phase. The action phase is optional. You're not required to take an action. The roll and the cleanup phases are mandatory. So each of these cards that you have, and I'll describe them in a second, is going to have an action on them and then a roll. And these are just kind of, I don't know, I think there's sort of arbitrary words that the designers came up with for what these things do, action and roll. I mean, it's just two different things that you can do. The overarching idea is that an action is something that is played out of your hand, that you have a card and it has some kind of action on it. You play it out of your hand and you can perform that action. So that's really the first step there, is that, you know, any one of these five cards is going to have a particular action on it. It's something that only you can do on your turn. You can play that card and do the action. Again, I'll go over the cards in just a second. Then you're going to do what's called taking a roll. This is the side effect deck building part of the game. This would be the equivalent to a buy step, I guess, except that you're doing more than just buying a card. That center tableau in the front, the different stacks of cards, those five cards, you're going to take one of those cards, and then you're going to perform whatever the roll is for that card. And so it'll say on there that, you know, you get to do some sort of an action. And if you're the leader, which means it's your turn, then you get an additional special action or special thing that you get to do with that roll. After you've taken your roll and decided what you want to do, then it's going to go around to each player, and they get to decide whether they want to either take that roll as well, or if they want to dissent, in which case they would draw a card. This may feel, if you've ever played Glory to Rome, it's very much like that mechanic of leading, and then if you follow, you can do the same action, or you can think, which is to draw a card, or draw a certain number of cards. And so it'll go back around, and then, you know, you'll perform those roles. And then the cleanup phase is that you take everything. The cleanup phase is different from Dominion, where Dominion, you would discard everything and then draw back up to five. Here you get to pretty much discard whatever you want, and then you're going to draw back up to five. So, you know, you're going to discard the roll card that you played, and any action card, anything you played onto the table is going to go into the discard pile immediately. But then you can discard any number of cards from your hand, and then you're going to draw back up to your hand limit, which is usually five, although there's things that can make it different. Everybody's going to start off the game with one planet. They're starting planets, and they're not cards. These planets are going to actually be these chunky tiles that are going to sit face down. Everybody starts off with one of those. And you also get a... it's a turn order card that shows you what the turn order is. And this is one of the most clever things in the game is this is the way that you determine the start player. You pass all of those out, and then everybody turns over their reference card, and on the back of it, one of them, it says start player.
It seems so simple. It may have been done before, and we just haven't seen it, but it was a very novel idea for
us.
Yeah,
like, ridiculously
it's built in, you know?
Yeah.
Very nice.
So there's three kinds of planets in the game, and they're either metallic planets, fertile planets, ooh, or advanced planets. And if you happen to get involved in the Kickstarter campaign, you may also get some prestige and utopian planets, some extra stuff there. But three basic planets in the game. So you're going to start off with one of those as your starting planet. And the backside of the card is going to have a couple of numbers on it. One is the warfare cost, and the other is the colonize cost. So when you survey a planet, you know, the picture on it, again, very cool artwork, almost looks like a computer readback.
Like you're scanning the planet.
Yeah, exactly. And so you're kind of checking out to see, well, what is it going to take for me to take over this planet? If you turn the planet over, then you get the nice big color picture of the planet and what it does, and it might provide special benefits and that kind of stuff. And so you're trying to sort of assess how you're going to take over the planet. You can do that by either, like I said, attacking it or by colonizing it. So let's go over the different cards and what they do, and then just sort of we'll get an idea of how the engine of this game works. So the first card that you have an option to use is the survey card. And so the survey has an action to it, of course. All of these have an action and a roll. The action for the survey card is that you can draw two cards from your deck into your hand. So this is a way of getting more cards into your hand. And then if you take that as a roll, which again, the roll is not played out of your hand. It's played from, you know, buying or acquiring one of those cards from the center. You pull that card out and set it in front of you, say that that's your roll. This is the roll that will allow you to look for planets. There's a deck of planet cards. And if you take the roll, then you can look at a number of planets that's equal to the number of planet symbols that you play minus one. and then if you're the leader, then your special ability is that you can look at one additional card. So this is where you can take cards that are in your hand and boost the roles that you're playing. So let's say the survey card is green and has this little green icon there. So you place that in front of you and say that that's your role. So then you can look at number of green icons minus one. Well, you currently have one green icon in front of you. That minus one is zero. Your leader ability says that you can look at one additional card. So it pretty much means you can take the top card off the planet deck as the leader and just go ahead and take that card if you want to and set it down in front of you. But let's say that you had three or four of these survey cards in your hand. Let's say you had three. You could take the roll, add your three survey cards. Now you have four of those icons. Four minus one is three. you're the leader, so you get to look an additional card. So you get to look at four cards now, pick one, and take it. So that's the special leader ability. Now, when it goes around to the other players around the table, they get a chance to also take that role if they want to, in which case they can play survey cards out of their hand, and they will get to take that role. Number of survey icons minus one is the number of cards they can look at, and then they can take one of those cards. That's how survey works. Make sense?
It makes sense.
Okay. The next kind of card you can have is a colonize card. And this is one of the ways that you can colonize the planets that you have just surveyed and put in front of you. The action on the colonize is that you can do plus one colony. And this means that you can take that card that you just played as your action, and you can tuck it underneath the planet that you're trying to colonize. And so that will count as one colony on your planet. And like we said, there's two numbers on those cards. One number is a warfare number. The other is a colonized number. And that colonized number is the number of colonies you have to get on that planet before you can what they call settle it, which is turning the card over and saying that you settled on the planet. So you can do plus one colony, and then you can settle one planet. So if you have the appropriate number of colonies already, then you can turn that planet over, discard your colonies, and you know now you have settled that planet. And you can start to get the benefits from that planet. If you take that as a roll, meaning that you're taking it from the center, then you're going to get plus one colony per icon, per colonized icon that you have. So again, you're going to take cards out of your hand and put them on the table, and you can put down multiple colonies. So it's like in all of these cases, the action card is something that only you can do. And so it may not be very powerful, but it's something that only you can do. Whereas in the roll card, it's something that everybody can do, but everyone's going to have to expend some cards to be able to do it. It might be a more powerful ability. And then the leader bonus for a colonized card is that you can settle a planet instead of adding colonies. So this would be another opportunity for you to settle a planet that you already have colonies on. Plus, you're getting that colonized card into your deck, because every time you're taking a roll, that's the deck building mechanic where you're putting that card into
your
deck.
And that's kind of a cool, I mean, it's a deck building mechanic, but it's also neat because it kind of represents leveling up in a way. It's like the more you do something, the more you colonize, the more you do warfare, the better you get at it, i.e. the more it comes up in your deck.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's a neat mechanic. That's kind of a neat way to show that leveling up or getting better at a certain task.
Sure, yeah. And so the warfare card is the other way that you can settle or take over planets. The action on the warfare card is that you can collect one fighter token. Now, they spared no expense with this game, and so the fighter tokens in this game are actual molded plastic spaceships. Mm-hmm. And so they're very, very cute, I guess. And they're different sizes, but I think they all count for the same. So it's just a token.
That's not annoying.
Okay, it's a little bit annoying, yeah. I guess. I guess you could have them account for more than, make change, like poker chips or something, yeah, if you wanted to. So you can collect one fighter token and you place it in your empire. You just place it in front of you. Or as an action, you can choose to attack one planet. Attacking means you're going to turn in a number of fighters equal to the warfare number on a planet, and you discard those, and then you'll be able to turn the planet over and you will have settled it by attacking it. If you take that as a roll, taking it from the center, you're going to collect one fighter token for every warfare symbol that's been played. Again, you can play more warfare symbols out of your hand. That's going to get you more of those ships. So like Cody said, if you've been playing warfare cards several times as rolls, then you're going to have more warfare cards in your hand, which means you'll be able to obtain more fighter tokens. So it really does build a different kind of engine of allowing you to do different things. So the leader bonus for warfare is that you can attack one planet instead of collecting fighters. So that's another different thing that you can do as the leader. But in that case, as it goes around, like I mentioned before, everybody can take that role if they play cards out of their hands appropriately. So then, okay, after you've surveyed your planets, you've colonized your planets or used warfare to take them over, you've got planets now that are your planets. What are you going to do with them?
What are you going to do with them?
I am so glad you asked. That would be the produce/trade card. And when you play that card as an action or as a roll, you will designate which one of those things you want to do. You either say, I'm going to produce or I'm going to trade. If you produce, then the action for that, if you play it out of your hand, is to add one resource token to an empty resource slot on your empire. So some of these planets that you turn over, they'll do various things. Some planets might increase your hand limit, so you can have more cards in your hand. Some of them might have little slots on them for tokens. And they're these little circular colored wooden discs that they use for resources. They're generic. Not one resource is much like another, except there's a limited number of them that you can that are in the pool in the game. So to produce, as you play as an action, you're going to put one of those tokens onto one of your planets. If you take it as a roll, then you're going to add one resource per production symbol. So again, like you may start to see a pattern here that, you know, the action is doing one thing that only you can do. The roll is something that everyone can do, but it's going to take multiple cards to be able to do it. So the leader bonus is that there actually is no leader bonus for the producer trade card. That's just kind of how it goes. The trade action is what you do after things have already gotten onto the planet. So once you already have those tokens on the planet, you'll play the trade card, and that will allow you as an action to return one resource token to the supply, and then you'll get one. Oh, you know, I called them prestige points, Cody. I was wrong. They're called influence points, influence tokens.
Oh, like Glory to Rome.
Oh, is that what it was? Oh, yeah, that's right. So that's what they're called. That's the points in the game. So my apologies for messing that up. But you're going to get one influence token for returning a resource from the planet into the supply. If you do it as a roll, then you're going to return one resource token per trade symbol that you play. So, you know, lather, rinse, repeat on these kind of ideas here. And so that is how a produce and trade works. That's one way that you can get points. Now, the final thing that I'm going to talk about is what we call the research action, which is sort of how you, we would call in Dominion, chapel your mm-hmm. your deck.
The auto chapel.
The auto chapel. The research action is that you can remove up to two cards from your hand from the game. So you can just take two cards out, just remove them from the game entirely. They go back into the box. If you play it as a roll, then this is the way that you're going to get these technology cards. There's three kinds of technology cards that are corresponding to the three types of planets: fertile, advanced, and metallic. And there's stacks of cards in the game, but you can look through them because they have different requirements. And they may require a certain number of research symbols, which are little light bulbs. So you might have to play the roll card, plus you're going to play multiple cards out of your hand, the research cards out of your hand, to be able to get these technologies. Plus, you may have to have a number of planets of a certain type to settled or in your control to be able to take that technology. And there's a whole bunch of different kinds of technologies, and too many to really mention here, but, you know, things like improved survey, improved colonize, where, you know, you get kind of boosted actions for these things. And then you can get into these level 2 and level 3 technologies, which require more planets and more of those research symbols that are going to give you much more powerful abilities. Plus, they're going to give you victory points, these influence points, at the end of the game. And so that's how all of the cards work. So I know it seems maybe a little bit complex, but there's only five cards, and each card has one role and one action that you can play. And, you know, once you get into the flow of this game and you see the engine that you have to build of surveying planets, settling those planets or attacking those planets, putting resources on them, trading those resources, getting technologies, this is the way that you get the points in the game. So that is the basic mechanics of the game. And, you know, the game is going to continue until either the influence supply runs out or if a certain number of cards is exhausted. And, you know, now that I think about it, it feels like I wasn't very prepared for this review, Cody. Sorry. now that I think about it, you play with the same number of cards no matter what number of players it is. It's just the number of stacks that are depleted to end the game.
The end condition changes.
The end condition. So for two or three players, if one stack of cards is depleted, the game is over. A four-player game if two stacks are depleted. And so then at that point, you're going to pretty much play through to the end of a round and until you get back to the start player. Then you're going to count up all of your points. So that is sort of the mechanics of the game. I feel like, as I've mentioned those, that it seems more complex than it actually is.
It really
is.
Isn't, yeah.
But it's really not. And so I've been talking for a while. Let me pass it over to Cody and ask him, what did you think of Eminent Domain?
Well, when we review games here at Game On with Cody and John, we do the buy, try, and deny system. We have buy points, which make you want to run out and play this game, buy it immediately. Try points, which may be good or bad, depending on your point of view. And deny points, which are outright terrible things we think exist in the game. So for me, for buy points, as I mentioned earlier, the artwork is fantastic. It's just really sharp. It's clean. Did a great job with the iconography, which in a game like this is very important. So it's just got a great look to it. And to me, I mentioned this kind of in a preview of this on Facebook, is that this is the first game that really feels like deck building 2.0. Where a while back we mentioned, you know, when will a deck building game not feel so samey? And this one up here is a nice step up. You know, deck building is a secondary kind of function for this. It's nice because it takes some elements from other games like Glory to Rome, Race for the Galaxy, Dominion, and it meshes this into this really nice experience where it's not over long. It's probably no longer than an hour, probably closer to 30 to 45 minutes. And it's just it's got really tight gameplay, and I think it just succeeds very well as a game. I can see why it was so popular on Kickstarter. So like I said, this is the first real deck building 2.0. I feel like we're finally moving away from just Dominion clones and rethemed versions of that. So big props there. Those are my buy points, John.
Yeah, I'll completely agree on the artwork and the component quality. I think they did a really nice job on that, and I was very, very pleased with that. I love the gameplay, and I love the playtime of it, is that it feels like a somewhat deep experience. You know, there's some really real strategy involved, and there's luck through the dealing of the cards, but you really, I think, can direct how your deck is built, I think even better than Dominion, because of the way things sort of build upon themselves. And then having sort of the built-in research card to be able to chapel and, mm-hmm. and get rid of the couple of cards out of your deck, you can shift strategies. You may go warfare heavy at the beginning, and you're getting all these warfare cards. And then after you've got all the planets that you need, well, now you're going to want to shift to producing and trading. And so you may want to get some of those warfare cards out of your deck, and using the research cards are ways to do that. So I really, really like it. I think it's a well-designed game, definitely. So,
Tri-points?
Tri-points for me in the time, you know, because I'm the game teacher, and you guys may have observed just over the last 15 minutes while I'm explaining this game that it may seem like I fumbled a little bit in what I was saying. And I think that has come through in every time I've tried to teach the game, is that it's really hard to convey the concepts of what you're trying to do in the game. Not as bad as Race for the Galaxy. I think that game is very, very, very hard to teach. And you feel like you can't get Race for the Galaxy unless you played it three times. This game, I feel like you don't quite get it until about halfway through the game. And then you start to understand, it may take one play, maybe less than one, but it may take one play if you're not used to this kind of game to figure out what's going on. But after that, you will have it. And, you know, and I played this with my wife, and it took her about halfway through the game until she finally realized, oh, this is what I needed to be doing. This is where I needed to be going. And so that's a try point for me, because it's not something I don't personally feel like it's something you can just jump into with a group of four people that have never played and have it down in 5 minutes. But it won't take very long.
Right.
Try points for you?
Try point for me is that if you're not a fan of the so-called multiplayer solitaire games, this game does fit that mold. And whether it's a good or a bad thing, you're kind of just focusing on right in front of you. You can see what other people are doing strategy-wise, but... Yeah, I mean, there is the action, the roll cards, and things like that. But, you know, it's deck building. It's a lot of focusing on your engine and getting your engine up and running. So just a word of warning, if that's not your kind of thing, if you like a ton of player interaction, this may not be for you.
Yeah, you may find yourself in a situation where, let's say you're doing all colonize actions. Like, you know, you're not building up your warfare or your, you know, plastic ships or anything. You just want to colonize. But you're playing with two other people, let's say, and that's all they're doing is warfare. Well, then you're not going to have any fun on that role phase because you're not going to have any fun, but you're not going to be able to do much because, you know, you want to use colonize. So every time they're playing warfare cards, you're going to dissent and just be drawing cards. And so there can be some unevenness there, I think, sometimes. But yeah, Cody's right. It really is you're focusing on your own thing more than you are what anyone else is doing. What about deny points?
I've got two. The first is I wish either all the plastic ships were the same size, or they just would have used tokens or something.
Yeah,
it's a minor gripe. It really is a minor gripe, but it's just kind of weird. I mean, I know they I think these are the same molds from Galactic Emperor.
Yeah,
that Adam West made.
Yeah,
local
same ships. Yeah.
So I mean, I guess they got a deal, but I don't know. I expected a little more for the money that was put into it. And the other one is. There have been some customer service reports with Tasty Minstrel, and then they've been hit or miss. So some from experience, some from what I've read. So just take that. You know, things could be better now, but
I don't know if that's not something that begins the game, though, right? Or I guess it could maybe keep you from buying it. Yeah, that's a good
point. Just throwing it out there. Just throwing it out there. My deny points.
Okay, they're your. That's right. They're yours and no one else's.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm not real crazy about the way the ships go there. And I will maybe echo what Cody said about the some maybe issues with customer service. Yep. That's all we'll say, though.
Needs to be said.
Yep, but it's a really good game.
It is.
And one of the better ones that I played this year, I think. So and it fits that sweet spot of 45 to 60 minutes, 30 to 60 minutes, you know, 2 to 4 players, a good deep experience in a short period of time. So that is Eminent Domain.
All right, thank you for listening to another academic episode of Game On, Cody and John.
Scholarly,
as you, we had a great interview with Scott Nicholson, a review of Eminent Domain, and it was just a good time all around, I thought.
It was very
but
good.
But you know what's going to be a great time is our top 11 episode, next episode for reals.
That's right.
As the kids say.
We pushed it back, but we can't push it back any farther.
No, the people demand it.
That's right. Yeah. And so we'll be bringing you our top 11. I'm sure we'll have other things of gaming note and maybe reviews, who knows. But the top 11 is what we're really focusing on.
And you know, one thing of gaming note that we want to bring up is it is that time of year for Extra Life when we will travel to the mothership, Myriad Games, and play games with other great podcasters for 24 hours in a row this year. We're doing in a row. We got what last year? 20?
20, yeah.
20. And so we tacked on some time at the beginning. We counted as good.
It's going to be rough for me because it starts at 8 a.m. and mm-hmm. my plane leaves at like 9:20. So I don't the next day. So I don't think I'm going to make maybe 22. I mean,
hey, we're gonna try.
Do the best I can.
We're gonna be playing to support Riley, a hospital for children here in Indianapolis, one of the best children's hospitals in the country, if not the world.
That's right.
So if you, we'll put a link in the show notes. You can sponsor myself or John to raise our money and get gold. If you just $24, $1 per hour, we are going to play as many games as we can, including hopefully John's Dresden Files RPG one shot, which I am all geeked up to play. Since
we're
going to
try it, yeah. But and any amount counts, so it doesn't even have to be a sponsorship for a certain amount of hours. But you know, you can just go to our Extra Life page and donate. It'll be like a direct donation, PayPal, or you know, something like that. And the 100% of the money will go directly to that hospital. And we got to say that we have actually some friends that. We used to go to church with that have a baby that's at Riley Hospital right now, born at 27 weeks,
wow,
which is too early. And
way
so,
too early.
And she is holding on and seems to be growing, and we keep her in our prayers. And so we're hoping that we can go down there, and her name is Mercy Roush, can go down there on her behalf and you know, play some games and raise some money for some great children's hospitals.
We also want to thank the people that earlier in the year made donations to the show so that we could afford to go out there and be a part, yes, of this great cause out in New Hampshire. So
thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And so while we're doing all this thanking here, we want to definitely thank our sponsors for this show, Myriad Games, on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere, sponsoring our show, and our additional sponsor for this show, Clever Mojo Games, all those great projects on Kickstarter.com. Go check them out here in the month of September and get in on those great games. So I think that about wraps it up for this show. And until next time,
game on.
Thanks for listening to Game On with Cody and John. Until our next episode, we invite you to check out our website at GameOnPodcast.com. There, you'll find all of our previous episodes, show notes, and a link to our guild on BoardGameGeek.com, where you can join in discussions with other Game On listeners. For even more content, follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast and like our page on Facebook. Game On with Cody and John is a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows like Out of Character, Fear the Boot, and The D6 Generation at PulpGamer.com. Until next time, Game On.